Caitlin Corcoran is one of the founders of the champagne bar in Westport known as Ça va, a French phrase that means basically everything's good or it's cool. Her stated mission there has been to provide champagne for the people, but the impact she's had on the food and drink scene in Kansas City goes far beyond the bubbly. In fact, her novel approach to hospitality, putting social consciousness at the forefront, is so striking that it got her a coveted James Beard Fellowship. In a nutshell,
if you come in and you're wasted and you're going to stumble into a group of people that you don't know and try to like aggressively hit on them, that's not okay here.
She's also done training for her staff to make her restaurant an official safe place for victims of sexual assault. She's put up signs declaring that Black Lives Matter. Her ideas come from personal experience as the person making the drink, serving the food, sitting at that bar, and loving those environments, but not always feeling safe or comfortable herself. Well, Caitlin Corcoran is moving away, so before she goes, we're going to find out what makes her tick and send her off in style. I'm Gina Kaufman, Caitlin Corcoran. Hello.
Good morning.
Icy roads are what you're going to really miss, right?
Yes, definitely.
So before we back up and hear your story, where are you going? What are you doing?
You know, I don't really know fully yet what I'm doing. I'm going to be in KC probably till May, but I'm trying to explore how to consult and freelance more, and I can kind of do that from wherever.
As like a beverage consultant?
You know, the consulting thing, I want to do beverage. I also would like to start doing trainings that are compliant with state laws for sexual harassment and do some of the anti-racism hospitality trainings as well. Plus, I have so much wanderlust, so I kind of just want to be able to travel and work remotely from wherever I am.
And the wine harvest has factored into this whole picture, right?
Yeah, so I worked wine harvest in Washington State this past year from August to basically like Thanksgiving.
What does it mean to work a wine harvest?
It means different things depending on what part of the world you are in.
Are you barefoot stomping on grapes?
Yes.
Sweet.
Yeah, that is actually a real thing. Even though I did not have an I Love Lucy moment doing the stomping of the grapes, I definitely had like a conveyor belt, like, oh my God, what's happening? Things are coming too fast. I Love Lucy moment doing wine harvest, helping bottle. But yeah, so I worked that. It was really great. And I would like to do that again. But for the Southern Hemisphere, which harvest is happening right now, Australia, New Zealand have a little bit harder visas to get if you're over 30, plus Australia's on fire. So there's that.
Yeah, there is that. Well, your decision to leave, I know it's personal.
Yeah. It's basically just at this point in my life, I've been in Kansas City 30 of my 34 years. I love it here. But I also want to see what else is out there. I have seen so many friends leave. And the great thing about Kansas City is you can always come back and you'll be received with open arms.
I feel like it's actually kind of a local sport that we participate in. You know, we've right. like really, we excel at the sport of leaving and coming back.
Right. And that, you know, it's the thing. It's home here. And I'm, you know, as we'll talk about in a little bit, I grew up here and my family's still here. So I will always be coming back to Kansas City. But I feel at this point in my time, I don't own a house. I don't have a partner. I don't have children. Why not just see what else is out there?
You have grown up in Kansas City and in Kansas City's restaurant scene.
Yeah.
Your mom is a pastry chef. I understand your dad's in finance. And that you would become a restaurant owner sounds like the absolute most natural thing in the world. But actually, your parents weren't totally psyched about that.
No, not at all. You know, I think that I've kind of started to unpack that more as I've done a lot of the trauma-sensitive hospitality training, but I realize now that my parents saw me as like a type A, driven, good at STEM human, and they were like, you have more, they thought there was more out for me than just the restaurant industry. And not saying like just the restaurant industry, but as I started to kind of go into that more, I realized my mom was a pastry chef in like the 80s. Like, toxic restaurants, like, still exist, but in the 80s, that was like the pinnacle of like coked out line cooks, sexual harassment out the wazoo. And now I realize like, oh, I get why you didn't want me to work in kitchens. Like, you wanted me to like be safe and not be sexually harassed at work all the time.
We are going to get back to all of that, but you mentioned yourself being like this good at STEM kind of kid. Tell me more about your childhood and like Caitlin as a kid.
Caitlin as a kid. So I was really into ballet. I danced with the State Ballet, which is now Kansas City Ballet, and Westport Ballet most of my upbringing. Took art classes at the Nelson. I was into eating out with my mom, especially because she let me sit at the bar, which I thought was like the coolest, most grown-up thing ever.
But it is the coolest, most grown-up thing ever.
And as I learned from her, you get great service, and usually it's a little bit more expedited if you're in a rush. But so I, you know, grew up doing those creative endeavors, but I also really liked math and science. I participated in Earthworks, which was a subset of, I believe, Exchange City, but it was all about science, and it was in the caves up by Worlds of Fun, and it was two different summer kind of programs that you just learned about nature ecosystems and learned to use microscopes as like a seven-year-old, which was really cool. But honestly, I always kind of gravitated towards the business aspect of things. Growing up in Kansas City, a really great foundation that we have here is the Kauffman Foundation. And when I was growing up, they did an entrepreneurship program with third and fourth graders, where basically we had to like come up with a business plan for like a week and do this program.
And you did that.
I did that, yeah. And the first year I set up a bakery, and it was super successful.
Wait, tell me about it. So you set up...
My mom and I like baked goods, and I sold them, and that was kind of my business model.
At school?
At school, yeah. It was a week-long, like, hour a day sort of, like, Exchange City, like, mini version. And then the next year, I wanted to expand and do something else as well, but they said I couldn't, which I think is a flaw in the program.
They don't train you in expansion.
Yeah, growth mindset is, like, super huge with entrepreneurs, so they didn't really, really foster that one. But so the next year I actually opened a library and then started dipping my toe into counterfeiting money. And
Wait.
Yes. Basically, I was pissed that I couldn't expand my bakery. So I was like, well, I'm just going to do this library thing. I don't know. And then I like realized that it was really easy to copy the money at my dad's work on the Xerox machine. My dad thought it was kind of funny being in finance, you know. And so I just...
And that was something that you incorporated into your entrepreneurship training.
Yeah, I laundered money as a fourth grader. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is what happens to you when you don't have a business to run.
Right, exactly. I go wild, you know. But besides all that, I really like a lot of my favorite memories from KC growing up are food related, you know, like Napoleon's Bakery in Westport was where I used to get all of my birthday cakes. Much to the chagrin of most of my friends. They thought I was weird. They wanted, like, white cake with icing. I got made fun of at my birthday parties for my weird adult-flavored cakes, you know? But then also, too, just, like, the Nutty Girl. I remember I was interviewed for the first time when
That was, like, very early, like, juice and sort of, like, healthy sandwiches place.
Barbara was, like, such an early adapter to this, like, health scene movement and like way too before her time, but it was like catty corner from Midtown School of Dance on 39th Street. And I remember getting interviewed by the paper when I was like 7 or 8 because I was like the weird kid who would go there after ballet and like get my like green juice and like wheatgrass shot. Like,
oh, tell me, you've referenced your mom a lot. Tell me just a little bit more about her.
Oh, Kathy Corcoran, Mama Cork. She's the best. She is like, mother to all she meets, hostess with the mostess extraordinaire. Yeah, she's lovely.
And what about your dad?
Mark Corcoran. Him and I just actually got back from an epic road trip from L.A. to KC, drove through Joshua Tree. He's awesome. He is now retired, loves golf, into finance, huge KU Jayhawks fan, always really supportive, especially with the math and science aspect of my upbringing. But also, too, when I would go to him during my college years and be like, Dad, you just need to tell me what to do. Like, I don't know what to do with my life. I want to do restaurants, but y'all don't want to do that. Want me to do that. What should I do? Never once would he tell me. You know, he was like, you're going to figure it out. And we just now have like great conversations about life, trying to figure out what I'm doing next.
You have referred to both of your parents in their early years, like courtship as Westport rats.
Yes. I mean, my mom was working at the original Classic Cup location, which is where Sweet Siam is today, which was not necessarily a restaurant also, but it was a wine bar, deli counter, my charcuterie to go. It was awesome. And my dad was working at Mercantile and came in one day and met her. But so some of their early dates were at the New Stanley, where Harry's is, or the Prospector, which is where Harpo's is.
It's interesting that this matters to you. I have no idea where my parents' dates were.
I know, but see, I always grew up going to Westport for the Reading Reptile and Murray's, and so while you're in that neighborhood, my parents would always talk nostalgic about the places that used to be, and I think sometimes we forget about some of those amazing restaurants in the late 70s and early 80s in Westport that really helped redefine that neighborhood during that time period.
What is your understanding of that story as it has been handed down to you from your parents?
You know, I just think the idea of community and how you can really create a community around certain spaces and how people gravitate towards that and have nostalgia for these memories. And it's not necessarily like the food they miss. I mean, sometimes it is, but really it's a feeling that they miss of that space.
So how did you get your own start in food and drink separate from your parents?
Well, basically, I wanted to get out of the way of going to Sunday Mass and church, so I found a coffee shop job because you have to work on Sunday mornings. And so I got hired at Latte Land when I was 15. It was me and, like, I went to St. Teresa's. It was me and, like, two other St. Teresa's girls and then a bunch of, like, weirdo KCAI kids and jazz conservatory students from UMKC. So it was a really, like, fun work environment to be in as a teenager because basically I've always wanted people to talk to me like an adult. And so it was nice to, like, start to see that. But yeah, so I worked at Latte Land on the plaza when it was just the two, which Latte Land is now Caldi's. But yeah, so that's how I got my start.
What were your initial impressions of being a barista?
Man, I loved the idea that I was taking this raw product and making it into something. I really thought that was cool. And I still think that, like, baristas and their skills are super underappreciated because unlike bartenders who are taking products that are made for them and mixing something, baristas actually have to create the liquid, like, the things that you're drinking in a really, like, intentional way.
I was a barista for a little while. I have no expertise in this, just a very little while. But I did love it. And actually, I think it's really similar to being a talk show host, except that you don't really know what you're going to be talking to people about from one guest to the next. They just file in, order a drink, and you do kind of interview them while they're waiting.
Oh, definitely.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, most definitely. That was the best part. Honestly, it's been really cool to grow up in the food and beverage scene in Kansas City and have regulars that have literally followed me throughout my entire career path. So I had people that were visiting me at Sava that I might not have remembered their names, but I remember that they were a 12-ounce skinny half a pack of raw sugar latte, because I do think that people have this relationship with their barista, because honestly, having done both bars and coffee shops, people are worse and they're more monsters before they have coffee than when they're wasted. So, like, you develop this very intimate, like, personal relationship with strangers quickly.
Or they're incoherent.
Yeah, or they're incoherent. But then you know, okay, that's not a talker. We don't need to engage. I can focus on other things.
And then you did get into bartending.
Yeah.
How did that transition happen?
So basically, you know, I was in coffee for 9 years, maybe a decade. And I had started doing barista competitions, which were really about creating signature drinks and kind of like special drinks that you couldn't do at the cafe and kind of weirdo flavors and modern techniques. And I really liked that. And I started seeing the kind of rise of the specialty cocktail scene come up, specifically in Kansas City and with Manifesto. And so I was like, oh man, people are doing that with bar stuff too. That's really cool. And I had tried probably for 2-3 years to break into bartending, but it was really hard because at the time, now it's very commonplace to transition from coffee to bartending, but at the time no one had done it really. And so I was trying to be like, no, like, I can bartend. I know I don't have it on my resume, but, like, I drink filled, I do customer service, I, like, do counter service, I can do this. And so it finally just took, you know, lots of convincing. But the week that I got hired for my first bar gig, I ended up getting two other jobs. And so I was like, well, I guess I'm going to, like, throw myself into this bartending thing and leave coffee.
So what are some of the places that people might know you from as a bartender before Sava, which is, of course, your baby?
You know, I think most people probably remember me from Port Fonda. I was there in the early days. I worked there for about 2.5 years, eventually became bar manager and then sort of like general or assistant manager on the floor thing. But I was always there working and hustling and grinding in those early days at Port Fonda. I also was at Kill Devil for a little bit when it first opened. And then I wasn't bartending, but I was a server at Manifesto.
You were really into terroir at one time. Maybe you still are. As a bartender, though, the first time I interviewed you, we talked about agave. You had just won a cocktail contest, and you had won with a drink that was based on agave.
So for those who don't know, terroir is the French word that means sense of place. And honestly, my entire career can be kind of like that is the one stream that is constant. So from coffee to bartending, it made a really easy switch because I focused on Port Fonda, and tequila and mezcal were kind of our focus points. And basically the same with coffee and then the same with wine is that for me, it's really important to know where the ingredients are coming from and the agricultural product, but also the people that are making that agricultural product into a beverage and just how they're stewards of the land and also respecting tradition and honoring the things that their generations before them did, I think is really beautiful. And also there's just terroir, especially with wine and agave, it really does affect the end product, you know, and you're able to understand what a place looks like, what it smells like. You can like conjure up, paint images in your mind by sipping it. And I think that's a really powerful thing to be able to transport yourself to someplace else.
The idea of a food or drink establishment being about more than food or drink is really important to you. I know that from the last few years of your career, despite being someone who is very into food and especially drink in a very material kind of way, as we just heard. Yeah, talk to me about the idea of like what a food or drink establishment means beyond the things you're consuming.
Well, I think it goes back to like why I cared about where my parents went on their first dates. It's this idea of community and the idea that especially now in today's age, chefs and restaurateurs and somms are cool. People think we're cool. You know, it used to not be a thing that we got much cred. And so we do have this like position of power when you own a restaurant or when you're a face for a brand that's food and beverage related. And I think it's important to
community status.
Yeah. And I don't know, my, you know, one of my tenets that guides me is try to leave things better than you found it. So why wouldn't I, if I've been in this industry now going on 20 years, why wouldn't I try to make it better? And for me, I think the biggest thing that I see is that for far too long, men, specifically white men, have had the position of power in the restaurant space and have dictated how hospitality looks. And unfortunately, as a lot of us have started to realize, power corrupts. And a lot of times the industry and the environment are not safe for women. They're not safe for people of color. And they're, you know, not safe for most of the workers. They're getting exploited and harassed daily.
You had an experience as a bartender that really shaped what would become your big ideas about what you might call radical hospitality. And it's a tough story involving sexual assault, so I want to give our listeners a heads up about that. But it's an important story. Could you tell it?
Of course. So I was doing bar prep at Port Fonda one day, and I look up over the pass, and I see the man who had raped me at this point 9 years previous. And I immediately went into shock because he had gone to prison and he had been released, and I never got the letter that said he was being released. So I didn't know that he was back out on the streets in Kansas City. And he used to be an acquaintance and so grew up in Midtown as well. So I would have known that he would, if I knew he was out, I knew I would have seen him, you know, but I didn't. So I was like, oh my God, what the heck? I run to the back and I'm spiraling into an anxiety panic attack, like full blown, can't breathe. And my boss basically looks at me and is kind of just like, take 5 minutes to breathe, but like buck up and get back out there. And I was like, wow. Like I literally, as a sexual assault victim, literally went through the channels. I reported, I went through the horrible process of a trial, which I understand why victims don't necessarily report because it's not a fun process. And I was like, I did the steps that you're supposed to do to be protected. And then this person can just come into my space of work and I'm not protected. Like, that wasn't cool. It wasn't congruent to me. And I was like, at the end of the day, I never wanted to be a employer or a boss that made my employees feel that way.
You know, it's an interesting thing because so many people's jobs are in sort of closed off spaces. When you work in a restaurant, anyone can walk in.
Right. Anyone can walk in. And so customer facing jobs, I think, are can be more daunting for that reason, because you don't know who you're going to see. And sometimes it's great because you get to run into regulars that you hadn't seen in a while, like we talked about previously. But sometimes you run into your rapist, and that sucks. Like,
I think people generally understand what a restaurant or bar can mean to the people who hang out there. Mm-hmm. The regulars, as we've talked about, that these are places of community. That is true in many cases for the employees, too. And for people who have never been behind the scenes in a Kansas City restaurant, can you talk about the relationships people have with these places, as in, like, work families?
That's funny, because I honestly just saw a meme recently that was like, if you work at a place that says we treat you like family, it means they're going to give you emotional abuse issues, which, like, is not untrue. And so I think that because restaurants are... it's a grind. The profitability is not really high. You're squeezing all the pennies you can. Long hours, late nights, early mornings. And most people are like coping with that by indulging in beverages that are alcohol or substance abuse stuff. And so you just have this really weird environment that can happen. And I think a lot of times boundaries are crossed for employees when they don't even realize it. And then it's like, for me, I know I had to step back out of it and be like, oh, so much of what I thought was just like restaurant culture is actually like toxic rape culture that I need to like unlearn.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, employees sleeping with employees, managers sleeping with employees and abusing their position of power in that regard is very commonplace in the restaurant scene. And I think that that can add to toxicity. There's a lot of, you know, in kitchens, since they're male dominated, there's lots of like phallic jokes that are made. There's lots of like, I think like in any HR situation, huge red flags that are like, would be deemed not okay to say, but in restaurants, specifically small chef-driven restaurants, there's almost never an HR program. No one runs that. So there's not even like a way to report if that is happening. And most of the times the people that are facilitating the harassment are the bosses, the owners, the people in power, the men in power, really.
You know, it's when people work in restaurants, they are just almost definitely going to be somehow off that sort of idea that people have in their heads of the conventional 9-to-5. Mm. And so your schedules are very like off kilter with everyone except other restaurant workers. So that maybe kind of contributes to this sort of insular world.
For sure. And I also think the great thing about restaurants is it's always kind of been like this ragtag pirate ship group of coworkers, you know, like we're all the misfits. Like, because until recently, like I said, it wasn't cool to work in restaurants. Most people wouldn't have like bragged about their son or daughter or child, the chef, you know, to their friends at a dinner party. Like, that wasn't something that they were proud of until recently. And so I think that because also it's like this just ragtag group of humans that are just kind of like all trying to figure out how to become, how to like make their way through the world in a non-linear, like normative 9-to-5 approach, it can be hard. And I also think too, you know, it's not just our restaurant industry, it's the whole world, but also too, a lot of times when you're abusing substances, you have a weird schedule, your mental health is at play, and people aren't really like, people don't understand that like you need to make time for yourself, you need to sleep, you need to drink water, you need to like have a therapist.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and when we return, we'll hear about how Caitlin's experiences translated into a whole new concept of hospitality for the restaurant industry, what that's looked like. This is a portrait session with Caitlin Corcoran of Sava as she gets ready to leave Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're doing a portrait session this morning with Caitlin Corcoran of Sava. That's a champagne bar in Westport. And Caitlin, explain your approach to hospitality, what it means to be welcoming as you have established it at Sava.
Right. So our ethos is the champagne for the people. And I think that a lot of times people could hear champagne and think it's fancy and high-end and pretentious, but when I reconcepted the brand, my big thing was trying to make it accessible for all. And so, of course, there's ways we did that with pricing and making, you know, training our staff on how to sell those wines that people aren't familiar with, because sparkling wine was weird when we, you know, started almost 6 years ago now. But really, my idea was if I didn't feel supported and safe at previous jobs. How can I make not only my staff feel supported and safe, but also my guests? Because I think, you know, the biggest thing for me with hospitality is that it begins with your coworkers first and how you treat the people you work with every day, day in, day out. And so if they're not supported and you're not having, you know, direct and open conversations and communication, then how can they communicate that hospitality to guests? So a lot of the trainings and just conversations I would try to have with my staff not only involved the trauma-sensitive training, like Safe Bar, that we did with MOXA.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So MOXA is a metropolitan organization to counter sexual assault. Safe Bar actually rose out of a conversation we had in this room right here about making Westport safer for sexual assault victims and potential victims. But basically, it just, A, defines and talks about what consent is, what is rape, what is sexual assault, but then also how to pick up warning signs and trigger signs. I think it's really important in today's era of dating apps that you can read the situation as a hospitality worker and know if someone is uncomfortable in that situation.
As possibly the other person who is present in someone's date with a stranger.
Right. Like, God forbid someone had a date at your bar and then got raped after that. Like, why? Like, you don't want people to go drunk driving, so why would you want people to get force-fed alcohol by their dining companion so that dining companion can be a predator later? You don't want that. So there's just different techniques. And honestly, you know, predators aren't that smart. Most of them use the same sort of thing, so it's easy to kind of see some of it. The hard thing is engaging yourself in that situation and knowing how to engage yourself in that situation. And honestly, it just takes like the whole staff understanding that that's not acceptable and that communication, like, okay, seat three is looking a little bit iffy. Like, let's maybe like all keep an eye on it sort of thing. But also at the end of the day, for me as the manager and owner, I was like, I will assert myself. Like, I'm the person that's going to put my neck out for you because at the end of the day, I don't want the backlash to affect an employee.
Can you tell... give an example of doing that?
Yeah, I think the best example was actually the first time I kicked someone out of Sava, which I was training a server, and this group, these two dudes were just kind of like on a tear. They had already started to try to talk to people that were next to them that they didn't know, and those people were kind of like, they checked out, they tabbed out early, they asked us to like sneak them out the back door because they weren't comfortable with those guys knowing where they're going next, et cetera, et cetera. And so that happened. And then we thought we were getting rid of those guys. And then they were walking out the door. And the drunkest one, of course, decides to sit at a table of two really attractive humans who he did not know. And I could just tell by the way these people recoiled in such a disgust that like that was not okay. So I'm training this new person at the host stand, and I see this happening, and I'm like, okay, you can follow me if you want, but I'm going to go handle the situation really quickly. And I just went over there and very directly was like, do you all want to give him your number? Do you want to go home with him tonight? No? Cool. So, sir, this is the second table that you've, like, made recoil and disgust by your advances. It's time for you to, like, move on. And he was very not okay with it, cussed me out a little bit. And then I learned you just treat drunk people like they're toddlers and everything's fine. And so I go, okay, I'm going to count to five. And by the time I get to five, if you're not gone, I'm calling Westport Security or KCPD. And so I was like, five or one, two. And by three, he was gone, you know. And the person I was training was just like, what? That's amazing. We can do that? Like, we can make sure that, like, the other people are okay and supported and, like, get the, like, creep out. I'm like, yes, every time we can do that. Like,
it might be surprising to some people that that's such a mental shift.
Oh, for sure. But I also think, you know, it goes with, like, cutting someone off. Basically, all humans just want the path of least resistance. And having to have that encounter really makes you have to, like, be direct and firm and also deal with the backlash of what could happen to you if that interaction doesn't go as smoothly.
Just thinking back on being, say, like in my early 20s, if I would be at a bar with friends, the idea that someone might come up and be sort of like creepy was just part of going to a bar.
Right, but it shouldn't be. Like, and I think that was my idea with Sava, was like, we're not a place that you like belly up to the bar and order a drink from the bartender and then go grab an open table. Like, it's table service, there's seats, like you have a server. It's a little bit more of a formal bar experience, especially for Westport when we opened. But at the same time, like, it's not a place where, because of that, strangers are just, like, getting thrown together and having to be forced into having a conversation with someone when really they're out with their two other friends and they wanted to catch up.
So it might, just thinking about this from the standpoint of not just protecting people from sexual mm-hmm. assault, you are also taking a stand on race. You have Black Lives Matter signage in your business.
Right. So for the radical inclusive hospitality, there's like three basic like kind of tenets that I focus on. And the first one is the trauma sensitive in regards to like sexual assault and sexual awareness, assault awareness. But then really the biggest one, which I think everyone should do this anyway, is talking about implicit bias with my staff and having them go to Project Implicit, which is an awesome website by Harvard. If you don't know it, you should check it out. And just making them do three bias tests. And just because I thought, you know, I think there's maybe 20 different ones you can do on that website, but it's really eye-opening to take that test privately. I'm not even asking them to like talk about it with me if they don't want to, but take that test and understand where your biases lie so that you can intentionally and mindfully try to give the best hospitality to everyone. Because unless you know about your own bias, you're blinded by it. It's all subconscious. And so in that same kind of conversation, being really active with anti-racism, you know, for far too long, people of color, specifically Black people, have been given bad service. Like, there's lots of like tropes around that and racism around that in the hospitality industry. And so to go out of your way to make sure that everyone feels comfortable and welcome is a big tenet for me. The last one, which is more newfangled, and I've had lots of conversations to speak about it actually, but this idea of non-binary customer service language, you know, it is 2020, you know, gender and sexuality are spectrums. If you don't know that, that's great. Here you go. That's my free information for you. But not always referring to people as he, she, and also just trying not to, like, when people come in the bar being like, hey, ladies, what's up? If it's
just
a group like, that you
assume. Gratuitous mamming.
Right. Like, if it's a group that you assume present as women, you don't freaking know if they do or not. Like, one might be transitioning. One might be non-binary and prefer the pronoun or have pronouns they, them, you know? Just understanding that there is nuance to it and it's not just what the status quo has always been.
What is, in your mind, the responsibility of a business owner to set the tone on things like this?
I mean, I think that's the point of why I want to own a business, is to be able to change the marker on that, because I think that not enough restaurants and not enough trainers and restaurants are talking about that with their staff. And for me, my idea at Savat was, if I can make this little 725 square foot piece of Westport that is mine, if I can make that the like ecosystem that I want to see throughout the world, and maybe my guests will start to have those conversations with their friends, and then eventually like it affects the whole Kansas City area and then eventually the world, you know, like kind of start small but have global ideas on how to change it.
It might, this probably makes this the place that you have created sound not very lighthearted, and yet I think most people would say that Sava is a fun place.
Oh, for sure. Like, I say all this stuff and we have these serious conversations, but a lot of times guests don't even know that. You know, they just know that they come in for good service and have a fine experience. They don't necessarily like understand all the trainings that we go through and all that, those like kind of hard and difficult conversations that were being had, which is like the point, because at the end of the day, like, you don't want to see some of that, you know? You just want to have the experience, because that's why people come into a place. That's why they spend money at your place, is they want to have an experience. They want to remove themselves from their life a little bit and be able to go transport somewhere else.
Get away from their troubles.
Exactly.
You know, you talked about wanting to take what you've done in this small space to a larger platform, hoping to see like bigger change in the world. Mm-hmm. And you did. You took this idea to the James Beard Foundation. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that and what came of that.
Yeah, so that's a really awesome fellowship program. The whole name of it is the James Beard Foundation Women Entrepreneurship Leadership Program, and it's based with Babson College as their big partner. But we had a kind of talk on the, I think it was like the first day. It was a week-long program, and the first day there's 20 of us, and everyone had to kind of talk about their value propositions and their ethos that guides them for their businesses. Everyone that attended identifies as a woman and is either owns a restaurant or owns some sort of like food space. So there's like ice cream shops, coffee shops, distilleries, that sort of thing.
From all over the country.
All over the country. And so, you know, I'm like midway through the pack and I start talking about the trauma sensitive stuff I've done and just some of this, these conversations, thinking, because I'm from Kansas City, you know, I'm a flyover state, that other people, specifically the New York and LA markets, people would have been having these conversations with their staff too. And after I talked, we had like a very good conversation about it because no one else had been doing that. Like no one else had even thought to do that. And, you know, one other woman who she owns, Kelly Field, she owns Willa Jeans. Her and I had similar experiences and not being supported with sexual harassment and assault in our workplace. She worked for John Besh for her most of her career up until this point, and he is a known predator in the restaurant space. And so it was really interesting to be like, oh, yeah, we can take those negative experiences and make sure that no one else has to feel that again.
How are you feeling as you get ready to leave? You have had this little carved out niche for yourself to sort of implement big ideas. Mm-hmm. And giving that up can't be easy.
No, but I do think that like with my network with the Beard Foundation, and I also did a business fellowship with Goldman Sachs in 2019, I think I have more of a national network now, and so I'm trying to leverage how to become more powerful in that. But also at the same time, I kind of got burnt out. You know, it's really grueling to be a small business owner. In the early days of Sava, I was there at 9:30, 10 a.m., and I didn't get home until 3:30 in the morning. Those are long days. And so for me, I just knew I wasn't going to be my best self and the best Caitlin if I stayed grinding in that space. So I'm trying to figure out how to still be able to have this platform and not necessarily work in the traditional restaurant model.
So what do you hope to learn on your next adventure, both personally and professionally?
Oh, man, that's a great question, Gina. You know, I think besides terroir throughout my career, like learning has always been the thing. I'm a lifelong learner. So honestly, I'm really interested in how to do the consulting thing for real and how to be organized with that, how to start freelancing. I'd like to write more. That's the next thing that I'm really interested in doing. The reception from the Beard article was really positive.
And you wrote an article for a national audience about all of these ideas that was really sort of, it got a lot of buzz.
Yeah, it did get a lot of buzz. You know, a lot of people were really surprised because they were like, oh yeah, kind of back to the fellowship idea, like this is a great idea. Why haven't we talked about it? And so just trying to figure out how to capitalize more and how to, yeah, just write a little bit more and actually get some of this pen to paper.
How would you define success? Like what would, when you talk about being your best Caitlin, you know,
yeah,
what would success look like? What would be some kind of cue that you'd achieved it?
I mean, I hope I never really know because I always want to keep striving. You know, I'm pretty competitive and type A. So if I get there, I might not have that like hunger in my belly situation. But I think for me, it's just having more balance, and which I know is very cliche, but being a little bit more mindful. And, you know, this idea that I've been working on since 2020 started, which will be a kind of a lifelong thing, I think, is trying to not define myself by how I make a living, which is, you know, we're in a capitalist structure and that's how people define themselves. I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be Caitlin who goes to guided meditation and does yoga. I want to be Caitlin who rides her bike. I want to be Caitlin who loves to go out and eat oysters and have a nice glass of natty wine. I don't want to be like, oh, Caitlin the bartender. Like, that's not how I want people to see me.
When you think about leaving then, I mean, you've talked about your family a lot and mm-hmm. It sounds like your family is very much rooted here.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, my brother and his wife live, you know, stone's throw from where we are now. And my nieces and nephews, Georgie, Cohen, Chloe, hi. You know, they are really important to me. But, you know, the thing with technology is there's FaceTime. And there's also planes and trains and cars and boats to get me back here. And I think if anything, they see how I've grown here already and know that I want to grow more. Because Kansas City is a great place, but I have my eyes on like bigger prizes, I guess.
When you think about that next step and you're doing some freelancing and consulting mm-hmm. and things like that, do you see you're in a transitional spot? Mm-hmm. Do you want that transitional spot to go on for a while, or are you hoping to land quickly?
You know, honestly, I am hoping that it lasts for a little bit. I really like the idea of getting like traveling gigs or doing more of a one-off agricultural wine harvest sort of like 3 month long job stints. But honestly, you know, if I could leverage a way to like get a visa to the EU, I would move to Europe tomorrow. So, you know, if I could be planted somewhere, that's kind of where I'm seeing myself.
Is there a story from your time in Kansas City's hospitality industry that you think you will be retelling with a hearty laugh for a long time?
Oh, man.
We've talked about the darker stories, but there have to be some funny, like, good, heartwarming ones, too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that anytime someone has allowed me to help facilitate like an engagement or like a special like anniversary, I think that's always been really amazing to be able to help tell their story years later. But honestly, I think a lot of like the funny stories are just going to be about like my weirdo drinks that I created, you know, especially throughout like all my competitions. Like the agave drink that you talked about earlier was like my like take on esquite asada, which is a classic Mexican dish that's like roasted corn and cheese. And I literally like infused corn like five different ways into this drink, and it's annoying and it was horrible, but everyone loved it, you know? And so just like some of the like silly like ideas I had involving flavors and modernistic technique, I think are my funny things.
So tonight it's an icy cold night in Kansas City. People are probably going to stay in all day and all night. If they're smart, they will do that.
Yeah.
What would it be like as your imagination maybe conjures a drink for this scenario?
Oh,
send us off with the drink, Caitlin.
I mean, classic hot toddy, I think. You know, like I'm kind of suffering from a little bit of a cold still, which I think everyone in the world is right now. But yeah, Irish whiskey, a little bit of honey, hot water, lemon orange, clove, cinnamon. That sounds great.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and this has been a portrait session with Caitlin Corker. And Caitlin, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Gina.
Caitlin is a founding owner of Sava, but she is leaving Kansas City, and we will be watching to see what happens out west. In just a minute, a guy went viral for leaving the football stadium last weekend. Is he going to have to do it again? The story of a superstition up next on KCUR Central Standard. So, if you follow sports at all, you've probably seen a video of a Chiefs fan. He created this video of himself letting his friends know he was leaving the stadium last Sunday when the Chiefs were down to appease his friends, who all agree that he is bad luck for the team. When, lo and behold, the Chiefs started winning once he left, that video meant for his friends went viral, and he's become kind of a phenomenon. Bad luck, Chuck is having some more bad luck today. He is on the road in the ice, and he was supposed to come here, but since he can't, I am talking to my favorite in-house sports expert here at KCUR, Central Standard Zone intern Noah Taborda. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Gina. Glad to be here.
So we are going to hope that Bad Luck Chuck has some better luck and can get in touch with us again in a minute, but tell us the story of Bad Luck Chuck as you know it. He actually didn't just up and leave the game.
Right. So, well, let's start at the beginning. The Chiefs, you know, they come into this game high expectations. It didn't start out as many fans hoped. And Bad Luck Chuck, well, he was lucky enough or unlucky enough at that point to be at the game. They are down, and he decides to, I guess, take one for the team and leave. He goes onto social media, and he begins to record himself explaining that he's leaving the stadium. He doesn't know what the problem is. And then at some point, he mentions, I don't know if it's true, and we'll get to what exactly was true in a little bit later as he leaves the stadium. And he says, well, I'm going to be home, and hopefully we come back and win.
All right. Chuck is on the phone with us now, but Noah, stay here. We may have some more questions for you. Bad luck, Chuck. Charles Penn, thanks for joining us, and I'm sorry about your bad luck as a commuter today.
Yeah, it's been something today.
I think for a lot of people. Well, so, your friends had been texting you, begging you to go. Is that right?
as far as, like, the game this weekend?
This past weekend. They had been texting you, asking you to leave. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because this dates all the way back to 2013 when I was over a friend's house. It was me and three of my boys. We decided to watch the Chiefs-Colts wildcard game. And I was the last one to show up. Everybody knows the outcome of that game. They told me that I could no longer watch the Chiefs game with them, and I should no longer go to a Chiefs game in public. And we fast forward. I'm over three in the playoffs attending Chiefs games.
You know, it sounds like your bad luck has been pretty consistent, or I could say the bad luck you appear to bring this team. So this past weekend, you go to the game, and then you leave, and then you go home, having shot a video and shared it, letting your friends know, hey, it's cool, I'm leaving. What happens when you get home?
As soon as I got home, the Chiefs finally scored, and then they went on a 51-7 run and won the game.
Do you think that you are bad luck?
I personally don't think so, but at that point, I was desperate because it wasn't going well.
It has to be frustrating to think that it's quite possible that this team that you love, maybe like the best thing you can do to support them is stay away. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
So what are
it
your
really is.
What are your plans for this Sunday? Will you go and then leave to replicate the scenario as perfectly as possible?
No. I'm actually going to be far away from Arrowhead Stadium. Believe that. So I actually got a watch party set up, so I will be attending that, watching the game.
Far, far away from the stadium.
Yes.
Well, Charles Penn, good luck on the rest of your drive home, and I'm going to discuss this your story with Noah so that you can get to a safe, warm place.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
But good luck not going to the game this weekend.
thank you.
Noah, this kind of superstition runs rampant in the world of sports fans.
Oh, it does. Trust me, I've had my fair share of moments where I've been holding the remote a certain way and my team scores and I'm like, I'm not letting go of the remote for the rest of the game. And you know, you got to do what you got to do for your team. When you care as much as Bad Luck Chuck does, you got to take the fall. And, you know, I'm sure Chiefs fans around the city are happy that he did.
If the Chiefs win this weekend, it will be a first in 50 years.
That would be a big deal. And if he does this, like he said, his reputation, he's been to a couple playoff games, and they've lost all of them. He went to the Patriots game last year. They lost that game. If he stays away this time and they can go to the Super Bowl, fans got to be really feeling pretty confident that he is, in fact, the reason that they might be winning or losing.
What do you recommend someone do with that kind of power?
I mean, do what's best for the team, you know? It's all about the team. Be a team player.
Spoken like a true intern.
Yeah, you know, we learn here at Central Standard, it's all about good teamwork and doing what's necessary.
So what will you be doing this weekend? Can you divulge what your own alliances are?
Well, I personally am a Green Bay Packers fan, but as somebody here in Kansas City, I absolutely want to see the Chiefs win. Not many people know the Chiefs and the Packers played in Super Bowl I, so it would be kind of cool to see a little rematch of that while I'm here in Kansas City.
Noah, what advice do you have for Bad Luck Chuck? I mean, is there anything that you can do to turn a superstition around? Like, do you just have to try and be present when you win a game and hope that everyone sees it and you can stop having this mark on you?
You know, I think Bad Luck Chuck will be happy regardless. I think he'll be happy if they win. I think he'll be happy if they lose. You know, he's a big fan. He's a good fan. But you gotta ride with the highs and the lows.
Okay, well, that's good advice for everyone out there because I know people's emotions get very invested in the outcomes of these things. And so you gotta ride with the highs and the lows, says Noah Taborda. Noah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina.
And Charles Penn, Bad Luck Chuck, thank you. And good luck to all the Chiefs fans out there. That's a wrap for today and for the week. Everything we've had on Central Standard all week long will be at kcur.org/centralstandard for your snowed-in weekend listening. So enjoy it. We have a lot of great content there. kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. Tell us about your superstitions, maybe. I don't know. We're at KCURCST, and we want to know how this weekend goes for you. Even if you are, bad luck too. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard is out. Up to date's coming next.